Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week, the podcast is once again about Russia's war against Ukraine. We're going to talk about developments on the battlefield and also about efforts by Russia and Ukraine to get more people onto the battlefield. As Russia's full-scale invasion approaches the 2.5-year mark, with no clear end in sight, despite plenty of talk about talks on how it might be ended. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Dara Masiko, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an expert on Russian military issues. Dara is the author of a report published this month by the RAND Corporation on Russian military manpower and the recruiting and retention of military personnel. Thanks very much for joining me, Dara.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show again. Last time we spoke on this podcast was in early March of this year, at a time that was really a bad time for Ukraine. There had been the unsuccessful counteroffensive in 2023. Russian forces had taken Avdiivka a couple weeks earlier, and a multi-billion dollar U.S. weapons and support package had been stuck in Congress for months. Things seem better now from the Ukrainian standpoint. The U.S. aid package was finally approved. A Russian push across the border north of the city of Kharkiv has not gotten far. And I would say that the doomy predictions that were prevalent for several months have receded. But at the same time, Russia has been advancing in at least a couple of areas, and the situation in particular around Pokrovsk and Toretsk in the Donbass seems quite dire for Ukraine at the moment. The top Ukrainian commander said last week that the battlefield situation was, quote, very difficult. Also, Russian attacks on Ukrainian power and energy infrastructure have taken a serious toll, which has made this summer a very tough one and does not bode well for next winter for civilians in Ukraine. Dara, a few questions here. One, I'd be interested in your assessment of the situation on the battlefield right now. And two, what are the main things you'll be watching for indications of how the war may go in the coming weeks and months? And another question that's broader, or even broader, with Viktor Orban's so-called peace mission, which took him to Ukraine and Russia and China, and with the U.S. election approaching, there's a lot of talk about peace plans and peace talks. Dara, not to go into much detail, but I guess I would ask whether what's happening on the battlefield has the potential to lead to ceasefire talks or to a serious effort to end the fighting.
Great question. So since we spoke in the spring, I would say the situation is not as dire as it was at that point when we were looking forward and forecasting the Ukrainians essentially running low on critical weapons and ammunition. That aspect has improved, of course, as weapons have begun to flow to the front line. But there still is a critical problem with manpower in some of these Ukrainian units that are on the front line. And even though they've mobilized additional personnel, it's not quite enough, and they're still in training. So there are some real issues there on the front line with respect to the manpower in these brigades. If we look at the situation on the front, I would say, I agree with the assessment. The situation in Donetsk is pretty critical. Specifically, the Russians are trying to reach a city of Pokrovsk. That's a very critical node in that region. And if they take it, then they get control over critical routes. And then the whole region there in Donetsk is at risk. This is a main effort for the Russians. They've been hammering away at it for 6 months. They are now advancing, in some cases, a few kilometers a day. The Ukrainian forces are very vulnerable, again, because they're stretched thin. They're very vulnerable while they're rotating. the Russians are able to target them and attack them. And there have been a few attempted encirclements at this point in the last few weeks that Ukrainian brigades have slipped out of. Up to the north in Kharkiv, that offensive, or if it was a diversion, it fizzled. I would say that it's fizzled is a fair assessment of it. The troops were pretty inexperienced. They were not given a particularly strong commander. And the attack appears to have been moved up in time. And so it's kind of stalled out at this point. It's more stable in the south in Kherson and Zaporizhia. From the air perspective, the air and missile strike campaign is really problematic. That the attacks on the electrical grid have brought down national capacity way down. People are experiencing daily brownouts. They're having electricity in major cities for maybe 4 hours a day, sometimes less. There are plans to try to mitigate some of it, but it won't be enough. We're looking at a pretty difficult winter ahead. So, where are we right now? The trend lines in Donetsk in particular are not very positive. I see a lot of exhaustion in that particular area. The Ukrainians are aware of it. But that's the main effort. The Russians are throwing bodies and equipment at it, and they're taking a lot of losses for it as well. But the problem is they just have more resources. And, for your final question there is, what does this mean for ceasefire talks in the battlefield? I try to stay out of the diplomatic side of this. But if I'm looking at pieces of this war, neither side, Russia or Ukraine, really wants strikes on their own electrical grid and, energy supply. So, I don't think either party is in a place to discuss an end to the war or ceasefire, but maybe there are things on the margins like agreements not to strike power targets on each side that they could come to some agreement to. I don't know, but I think that there's parts of this that maybe they would discuss, but again, that's just just my view.
I see. Thanks very much. And that's interesting, given, of course, the, I mentioned how much talk there is, and in particular with Donald Trump running for president and promising that if he's elected, he would end the war in 24 hours, 48 hours, essentially before he is inaugurated. So, but at the same time, many observers say, neither side is kind of advocating for is ready for the kind of ceasefire or the kind of deal that the other side would accept. So your mention of kind of smaller, I guess, side agreements is interesting. I hadn't really heard that before. So thanks for that. And I just wanted to ask a follow-up on kind of the battlefield situation. You mentioned that this effort by the Russian north of city of Kharkiv, northern part of the Kharkiv Oblast, has fizzled, and that may have been a feint. I guess the question is, does it seem like it seems like, and I think Putin has even said this, but that at least one part of, or maybe the most immediate Russian goal, is to take the entirety of the Donetsk region. They hold almost all of the Luhansk region. Is that something that looks like it could be, possible in the coming, months or year?
Well, it's certainly the main Russian effort. It's a complicated picture looking at them because there is a lot of adaptation that they're doing. But then they also make really questionable decisions as well to initiate that attack on the Kharkiv Oblast. Not taking those forces and committing them as reserve to their main effort, which is Donetsk. They were told by the Kremlin, presumably, I need a buffer zone. I don't want this territory to be shelled, so we're gonna park you up there in Kharkiv, and it just didn't work probably the way that they had hoped. Yeah, it's I look at what they're doing with the force, and it's clear that Donetsk is the oblast itself is a major objective. The problem, for the Russians is that they're throwing a lot of resources at this, and the air attacks in particular with the glide bombs are really problematic. The Ukrainians are reporting that the rate is up. In that region, very damaging for those units there. But even with all those advantages, we are still looking at an army that's crawling forward, kilometer by kilometer, and taking heavy losses for it. And so you might look at that and say, well, that's not a success for the Russians. This is going to take them months, to get there. But if you park the territorial change aside, and you look at what's being done to the Ukrainian units on the front line, that's the more problematic story. They're getting stretched. They are not able to rotate them. They're taking casualties, and they're not backfilling them at the same rate. So that's what I'm looking at for how long units can hold like that. They have weapons, but the manpower is still a challenge.
Okay, thanks. Let's turn to your report for RAND, and you've mentioned some of these aspects in terms of mobilization and manpower. The report is titled "Russian Military Wartime Personnel Recruiting and Retention," and it covers 2022, obviously the first year of the full-scale invasion, and 2023. The introduction says that in your research you've, quote, identified several efforts that Russia's government is pursuing to stabilize wartime recruiting and retention and to mitigate emerging problems when the war ends. However, the soldiers are but there are several problems. Sorry, I'm paraphrasing here, but several problems that Russia's experiencing that will undermine its efforts. So the wording here, and I believe it mentions heavy casualties, poor force employment or use of forces, and flawed unit leadership, does seem to suggest major problems on the Russian side in several aspects, of the invasion. Could you talk about a little bit about these problems and what clues to the course of the war they may contain? And also, apologies for all the questions, but and again, you did mention kind of the personnel and manpower problems on the Ukrainian side, but how the situation in Russia may contrast with recruiting efforts and manpower on the Ukrainian side.
Yes, so that report, I wrote that one was completed last September 23, and that was the last report I did for RAND before I moved over to Carnegie. And it's really looking forward into the future, what becomes of the Russian military, specifically maybe its army and airborne after the war ends. They still want to have a professional force where volunteer, professional, enlisted. Officers want to be part of this organization. Conscripts are not doing extreme measures to evade the draft. But the way that they've prosecuted this war is very incompatible with the type of force that they want, and indeed the kind of force that they were trying to build over the last 15 years. So they've undone a lot of the goodwill that they worked really hard to get in Russian society with the way they're doing this. So the report focuses on two issues. One is recruiting after the war ends, and one is retention. How do you retain the people who are fighting it now? Because there are some of them you don't want to retain, and there's some that you do. They're two separate issues. To me, retention is going to be the more difficult challenge for the Russians. And right now, the way that the mobilization laws are working is that all the fighters who are fighting in Ukraine are there indefinitely until mobilization is ended by the Kremlin. So in the West, we used to call this stop loss, meaning you can't actually leave unless you are killed, grievously injured, and you can't return, or you age out, or you commit a crime that's so bad that you get imprisoned. So, like, we don't actually know, and I don't think they know how deep their retention problem is going to be because everybody is artificially held in place. So, what happens when they remove those barriers? Does everybody run for the exits? Who wants to stay? How do you demobilize these men and put them back into Russian society after everything that they have seen and experienced? A lot of them are going to have very challenging problems reintegrating. We're already seeing that now when they're on home leave. They're quite violent, some of them. So how do they demobilize them? And then if we look at the recruiting issue, I think the recruiting picture is not going to be as complicated. In the short term, of course, we're seeing them throw incredible salaries and social benefits at people to get them to volunteer for the war effort, and they're having to raise those incentives as time goes on. So it will reach potentially a stopping point. We just don't know where that is, and they have to consider a next round of mobilization. But again, looking in the long term, there's actually a logic to how the Kremlin is trying to move past this and recruit the next generation of recruits. Okay. And they're doing it with a couple of different ways. They're suppressing bad news and criminalizing talk that disparages the armed services. They are ramping up their military patriotic education in middle school and high school because they're trying to think about that next generation of recruits. And they're also, and we talked about benefits, they're also linking the war repeatedly to World War II. And they're trying to make this visual and mental connection between, the hero liberators of World War II and the veterans and soldiers who are fighting now. So, like, there is a coherent plan. The question for all of that is, will the Russian population buy it? Will they, again, will the soldiers run for the exits as soon as they're able to be demobilized? Will they come home and tell their family and friends everything that they experienced, sort of the cruelty and the war crimes and all of that? And will people hear all of these things and not want their sons to join an organization like that? The policy is one thing. But again, whether the population opts in or not is another. So I would end, in peacetime, memories fade and it's not as risky. And if they keep those high salaries and high benefits up, there are going to be people who are attracted to that. But again, a lot of it is so contingent on how this war ends and the pressures within the defense budget. So there's a lot of moving parts, but we're tracking it. And on the Ukrainian side, they are facing recruiting challenges in the short term. Volunteer rates to join the Ukrainian armed forces have slowed down. There's a lot of concern that it's a one-way ticket, and or they'll return home with amputations or other very serious medical problems. So recruiting is a problem in the short term on the Ukrainian side. There's a different set of challenges, though, when we look out into the future for Ukrainian recruiting and retention. I think there are a lot more positives in terms of the culture, Ukrainian military culture, to take care of people. It's still a work in progress, and they're transitioning as a military away from this Soviet, background. But that's something that we'll have to see as well. How and when this war ends is going to shape the recruiting and retention challenges they're going to face in the post-war environment.
Okay, thanks. Yes, huge question mark or question marks in terms of how the war how and when the war ends. I guess I just would follow up with a question about kind of what you're looking at, maybe one or two things that you'll be of the main things you'll be watching, I guess, in terms of the battlefield to see where this is headed in the coming weeks and months.
Well, the place I'm looking at the most is what's going on in Donetsk on the ground. Again, the pressure is really mounting on those units, the Ukrainian units that are there, and I have some concerns about their ability to reinforce. The other issue moving forward is the critical issue of Ukrainian air defenses. They have been resupplied with Western kit, at least with interceptors, but overall they don't have enough. And the Russians are really ramping up the glide bomb use, and they're starting to be well, they have been for several months very particular in what they're targeting with their long range missiles. So that's a problem to me. The other issue is the Russians may be anticipating that Ukraine is going to get release authority for ATACMS strikes into Russia because they're already starting to move back some of their fighter jets to airfields that are further away. So that would make ATACMS strikes slightly less effective, depending on how well they're able to do that. So, I think some critical periods here, in the next couple months on the ground in Donetsk. That's the main thing for me.
All right, thank you very much. So comprehensive look at several aspects here. So I very much appreciate it, and we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for joining me, Dara.
Thanks so much.
All right, my pleasure. Once again, I've been speaking to Dara Masiko, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who focuses on defense and security issues in Russia and Eurasia. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.